CIA, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza. Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Pete the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
See, watching this, like, I just want to go and
adult themes.
But, like, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back, finally, to the Super Podcast. I am your host, Super Marcy, and yes, it has been a little while between episodes, but we are back. Joining me today is my wonderful co-host, Bede Jermaine. Hello, Bede, and how you doing? Welcome back to the Super Podcast.
I am good, thanks, Marcy. It's nice to be back on the Super Podcast. It has been a little while.
It has been. Life gets in the way.
Yes, exactly. But I am really happy that you and I have got back together to do an episode of the Super Podcast. We've been meaning to do it for sure. But again, like you say, life lately has been all over the place for both of us. But Marcy, I'm very excited for this one in particular because we have a very special episode lined up for our audience today.
Yes, we do. We are back with a bang, so to speak. For this episode, we are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the release of the 2000 Australian film Angst. It is now available for the first time in a very long time for people to check out on both VOD and physical media. So this is very, very exciting. But not only are we celebrating and discussing this film, we have a special guest joining us, and it is the writer of the film, and we are going to have some fun chatting all things Angst. So, Bede, are you ready for our audience to hear our interview?
Indeed. And here is our interview with the film's writer, Anthony O'Connor. So enjoy, everybody.
So what's with all this angst?
And joining us today is a very special guest who is the writer of a little Australian film that is currently celebrating its 25th anniversary. And it's one that has finally, after so many years, been released on physical media and as well as streaming platforms. And that is the film's Angst. And with us today is the film's writer, Anthony O'Connor. Hello, Anthony, and welcome back to the Super Podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me. Lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think it's been many years since we've actually sat down and had a chat about one of your writing projects. So it's very cool to reunite, especially for talking about Angst, which not only is it its 25th anniversary, but it is no longer almost a lost film. It is out on physical media and on available online. And for a long time, I think it was only really available on VHS, and then VHS faded out and it wasn't on DVD. Obviously, for you, how does this feel that you know, this is going to get a whole new audience. It will be rediscovered. Like, that's got to be pretty freaking awesome.
It's quite surreal, actually, because Angst came out in 2000 and we'd been, I wrote it when I was sort of 18, sold it when I was 19, and then developed it until I was 23, and then it came out. And we had some nice reviews and everything, particularly from David Stratton and Megan Spencer at the time, but it just didn't find an audience at the cinema, and then which was a bummer. And then it came on to VHS, and it was huge. It was this kind of growing cult hit, was always rented out because I worked in many video shops. So I had friends in video shops going, we can't keep your fucking film in. Like, it's always rented out. And then people started stealing it. It ended up being the most stolen video in Australia.
Oh, shit.
like this is internet piracy before, you know, we had internet piracy.
Yeah.
So discussion began. We were going to do this like great DVD release with a whole bunch of extras. We were thinking like, great, this could be the second life that the film needs. Maybe this was really the intended audience, because you think about the film, it's very much set in lounge rooms and with people on couches and that kind of stuff. And then this is where things get vague, but one or more of the companies involved in distribution either collapsed or amalgamated or what have you. And that was that, locked onto VHS. Where it was very frequently stolen. And that was it. It kind of became lost media. And over the years, I've had sort of people, usually at kind of industry events and whatnot, say, hey, when are we going to see a release of Angst? And, you know, I sort of shrug and go, I don't know, man, like, probably never. And then in 2024, so last year, Dov Cornett's of Film Inc. fame has a festival called the Inner West Film Fest. And he took the 35 millimeter prints from Jonathan Green and had them in a just a single session, like a screening. And it went gangbusters. Like, it went really well. Like, a bunch of people who were involved in the film were there. And of course, you know, they all liked it. But a bunch of like younger people or people unrelated to the production saw it as well. And there was a really good kind of buzz, I guess, about it, which then led to sort of people behind the scenes going, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to dust the old girl off. So look, it's better late than never, as I'll say. I would have liked the feature-rich DVD to have come out in, you know, 2000, 2001. But it's still nice that it's happening in 2025.
Better late than never is definitely...
fashionably late movie release is how I like to think of it.
Pretty much. And, you know, over the past few years, Bea and myself have been working our way through watching Ozploitation films, and some we found, like, I don't think anyone has seen these films in like 40 years. Mm. And the only way we could see it is somebody's ripped, taped off TV VHS copy. Like, these things are so lost, and just not knowing how easy it is for something to be just lost in the void, and like, who else has seen this? For your film to just be making like this re-release now, it is, the right words are just not there. It's awesome. It's amazing. I love that it's not really a lost movie anymore. It's here. And I'm all about preserving Australian cinema. I don't care how shit it is, it's still art. So, I'm not saying Angst is shit. Angst is fucking fantastic.
I was actually thinking of, do you remember that movie Houseboat Horror that got a re-release?
Oh, we're very fond of Houseboat Horror.
and I think another one, got like Blood Moon or something like that. I think I might be getting the title wrong. It was like a Australian slasher that involved a lot of topless nudity and barbed wire killings. And I just think, like, I actually love those kind of trashy films. What's weird about Australian, like, exploitation films, and I think we share this with the Italians, even the worst of them look amazing because we have like the best cinematographers and the best, like, you know, DPs here. So it's just wonderful seeing these, like, you know, god awful films in a great way that look like $1 million and definitely did not cost $1 million.
No, and there's the passion that people have. Like, we just want to make something. I think the fact that we are in the year that we are in. And yeah, it makes us feel really old. But the fact that films can still be rediscovered and they're not actually lost, and idiots like me and Beat have found movies that no one's probably seen for 40 years. Like, I feel it feels good to see things that are being preserved and finding a new audience. And it is so cool that angst is back in a way, and it will find a new audience. And rewatching the film, like, it had been that long since scrambling to find a VHS copy back in the day.
Yeah.
It had been that long since I'd seen it, and I fondly remember, like, that was a film that kind of hit me hard, because I'm like, I kind of relate to a lot of this in certain ways. And then watching it again, it's like, wow, this hits on so many levels now. And I think it's because I'm trying to get to somewhere. There's a universal truth that you have in the film, but it's also that nostalgia factor, like, oh, I lived through this. I remember what this was like. But so many things just being very relevant for today. Like, it's an incredible experience.
I think there's two things going on with angst. I think you've got the kind of universal themes of people looking for a place where they belong, and they kind of found family and stuff. And I think that is a sort of timeless notion and has been explored in fiction for, you know, all time, and will continue to do so. I think also we had an interesting timing of the release of Angst, which was right when everything was about to change. So VHS was about to die and become DVD, which would then become Blu-ray, which would then become 4K, which would then become streaming. King's Cross went from a place where on every street corner you could either get a root, drugs, or a punch in the head to this kind of vacant strip mall that it is now. I mean, it's not that bad. There's some parts that are still quite nice, but like the actual main strip has been so denuded of the sleaze and crime that made it fascinating. I don't think it necessarily made it good, but it made it fascinating. And technology, like, there's a whole subplot in Angst where Dean is kind of lamenting the idea of using a computer or a machine to have a love life. And that is just the norm now.
It's the norm. Like,
that is completely, I mean, who's getting laid without fucking the apps? No one. So it's a whole, it was right on the cusp of a real kind of sea change in a bunch of things, which in retrospect makes it look kind of like, oh, it really captured a moment. Whereas for me, I was just writing about the stuff that I knew and shit that made me laugh. But I mean, we at the screening, people would laugh at things, not just because they were funny, but because there was like dial-up modem. And stuff like that, dial-up noise. But that was the noise of, yeah, we can now communicate with our friends and whatnot, back when it was all a bit innocent, not kind of full of Nazis and shitheads. So yeah, I think it's two things going on. It's the universal themes of looking for where you belong, combined with, oh, do you remember the 90s? That was crazy. Because I mean, I know it came out in 2000, but it was very much a 90s film.
90s.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's why I find things like that fascinating, with that it was the time shift, like things were changing. We just didn't quite know it yet. And it's interesting, like, I guess, to look back that it does capture this moment in time. There are a few films where I genuinely mean when I say that they've managed to do that. And I do find that a lot with Australian cinema, just perfectly encapsulates this time in life, but it's very universal to just life in general. I feel like I should hand it over to Bede, because I'm sure you have burning questions and I'm rambling on, because I'm just so happy with this film being out and revisiting it and just being able to talk to Anthony about it.
Oh, that's awesome. Sort of rewatching the film again, Anthony, and like Marcy, I watched it when it came out and I enjoyed it then, but rewatching it again now, it kind of hit me a lot more harder this time around, because even though, yes, all the characters in the film are like in their early to mid 20s, there are still things in it that I'm like, oh yeah, I completely understand what these characters went through, at least at that time, and in some ways still going through now. So it's kind of interesting how, again, no matter what age you are, the film can still hit that much. But I guess knowing that you wrote the script to this at the age of 19, where did the initial idea of wanting to do Angst come from? And also, how autobiographical is the film? Because watching the film again, there are just little details in the film that felt like, oh, this isn't something that came out of someone's imagination. Like, this was like taken from real life, because I don't think even our imaginations could come up with some of the really sort of oddball, quirky elements in this film. So where did it sort of like wanting to write this particular story come from?
Well, much like Dean from the film, I always wanted to write horror movies and you know, be the horror guy. The problem was, so I'd started writing scripts when I was like 15 or 16.
Relatable.
And the problem was they were awful, god-awful, just like derivative rehashes of films I love, like Evil Dead or, you know, a bunch of Cronenberg films or John Carpenter films. And Frank Henenlotter's Brain Damage, which I remain obsessed with to this day. It was just, there was no kind of truth to them. There was no spark, and there was nothing, because I was a teenager. I didn't know anything. And, you know, I thought, I don't know who said it. I might've read it, but you know, the old trope of write what you know, kind of, someone said, hey, maybe you should write something about something more personal. And that became Angst for the Memories, which was, I mean, it was definitely quasi-autobiographical. Obviously, Dean shares a lot of similarities with me. Jade was kind of, you know, friends and you know, women I liked and knew. Ian was a kind of amalgamation of a few friends I had. And a lot of the situations, because by that time I was working in a video shop. I was working in numerous video shops, actually, but the main one I worked in was InVideo in King's Cross. And as Kevin Smith could tell you, customers are an endless supply of anecdotes. Like, they just,
yeah,
like, particularly in King's Cross, as you can imagine, you know, we had our share of toaster junkies and psychopaths. And so I think in the early offings, it kind of was a lot more episodic and just a bunch of stuff that happened. And as time went on, it had a little bit more to say about finding a place and kind of identity and what it is to live as the person you want to be and all that kind of stuff. But again, first and foremost was this sort of romantic story. I used to balk at calling it a rom-com, but you know, I see it now and I'm like, it's definitely a rom-com. Like, just because the characters talk about Lucio Fulci and get stoned doesn't mean it's not a rom-com. So I can admit that now, 25 years later. So a lot of the things that happened were real, but exaggerated for comedic effects. And obviously, you know, how all the stories intersect at the end and there's these moments of triumph, that was mostly invented. But it did come from a grounding in reality, which was really important for me, because it was the difference for me, and I'll get in trouble here for slagging off one film, but I'm going to do it anyway. So the reason I love something like Kevin Smith's Clerks is because it feels like this shit happened to Kevin and crew. Like, this is based on real. And then there was another film that everyone loved at the time, which I to this day can't understand, which was Empire Records, which kind of was this weird veneration of large franchise video shops. And maybe in America they were different, but over here, I just remember them being shithouse and everyone who worked in them hated it. And, you know, you had to wear uniforms and whatnot, which was just insane to me as a like an indie video shop haunter. And I watched the film and, you know, the cast was great and it was fun and well-produced and all that kind of stuff, but there was no truth to it. I didn't feel like I was watching a film based on people's experience. I felt like I was watching a film that was, well, the kids like X, let's put X in the film. And the kids like Y, so let's put Y in the film too. And I didn't want that to be how I wrote it. I wanted this to be based in, grounded in reality and with a sense of truth to the characters at the same time as being funny. So that was always the give and take. Like, you had to have like people's real, you know, neuroses and fears and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you had to have the jokes be good. So yeah. That was kind of, that was the crux of it.
And it works.
Thank you. I mean, I hope so.
That's why I can say it.
I remember at the time being concerned that it was too niche, and I think it was definitely too niche for a sort of cinema audience. But yeah, I mean, just how it exploded on video was always very telling.
I think the reason for that, well, part of a reason for that is, like, it's a film that appeals to, I don't want to say outcast, but that's how you felt in the 90s if you had the more niche interest. So it appealed to us outcasts. And I think that's why it found that life on VHS, because we were always at the video store. We were always consuming everything we could. And it's just so relatable, I think. Even if I was younger than the characters, I'm like, there's a lot of me in there. Like, I want to write horror movies. I want to watch horror movies all the time. Yeah. I wish I could work at a video store, you know?
Marcy, do you remember the 90s too, that there was such a snobbery around, like, liking horror movies? Like, there was something wrong with you? Like, there was a real kind of sense that, I mean, there's a bit where, you know, the 12-year-old girls he ends up accidentally going on a date with, one of them says, I hate horror films. Isn't there enough violence in the world? And I heard that over and over again then. Like, it was like this old thing that people would bring up, like yeah, because I like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It means I want to wear people's skin. Like, it was this weird attitude to nerd culture in general, but specifically to horror culture. And now, like, you know, the biggest kind of movies and podcasts about movies, and it's so celebrated. But in the 90s, particularly in Australia, it was a real kind of ghetto genre that was not respected.
We sort of had, I guess, being so linked to the UK with video nasties and all that controversy, I think, really sort of put horror into this just negative thing. And I distinctly remember, like, you know, horror was that taboo thing. Again, you have your film, and these are the movies I watch. These are what your characters are watching, because that's what we did. If, you know, it was, you couldn't find so many things because the horror section would just not be that big. And you'd have to go to the indie shops where you'd have the owners or the workers who are like, oh yeah, fuck, we love this shit. Like, it, because I had that, like, when this new video shop moved in and they had all the stuff I could never see, it was the best feeling ever. And I think almost being jealous that it's like, how the fuck did you get to rent all these, like, movies from the one video store? It's like, I can't find Night of the Living Dead and Evil Dead at my local.
God, that's grim. No, I mean, that was pretty much ubiquitous in video shops, those two, because those two never stopped being rented. Like, those, I mean, all through the 80s and 90s, like, those were just constantly out. It's funny how, like, films like that just stood the test of time, like a few others, just evergreen. I also like the video shop guys that you would talk to, like, particularly in the indie ones. You'd find a guy who, like, in, like, this guy gets me, and he'd be like, I've discovered, like, Phantasm sequels that way, and all sorts of stuff, just having the right guy go, you all should see this. And George Romero's Martin, like, I knew his zombie stuff, but it was a guy that was like, have you seen Martin? That shit.
Yeah, I had that kind of guy when that video shop moved in, and I'm sort of like, all right, what have you got in this? And he's like, okay, I know what you want. He's like, we actually have, like, horror movies that nowhere else really has anymore. And I'm like, gimme, gimme, gimme. If they were doing their ex-rental sales, he'd put stuff aside because he knew I'd probably want them. Like, that's awesome. They knew me. And they'd always be like, all right.
What a legend.
Give us your recommendations. Like, I was too young to work at the video store, but the customers would come to me and be like, okay, what do you recommend?
Yeah.
I miss that so much.
I miss the social aspect as well.
Yeah.
It's tough now because I think a lot of films, Umbrella did a recent release of Freaked, that Alex Winter film.
Yeah.
And like that, I saw that in 1993 and it blew my mind, and all my friends hated it, thought it was a try-hard movie, but I loved it. And then that more or less vanished in this country, particularly. I think there was a Anchor Bay Blu-ray at some stage. But it was just interesting to see how this is happening quite a lot now. Like, a lot of sort of beloved but kind of lost films are getting a second life. And I think that's really nice.
It's really beautiful.
Well, I've been liking it for a while. So it was quite a delightful surprise to have it happen to my film. Because, you know, I was like, oh, okay, this is cool.
It's pretty freaking awesome.
Yeah, man, yeah.
I know Bede has something related to a podcast he does.
We do, because I had to laugh because watching the film, and then of course Night of the Living Dead pops up, and of course, if anyone knows, I do host a podcast that's all Night of the Living Dead centric called Bede versus the Living Dead. Now, I've obviously, it's a big part of the film because it is shown quite a few times, but I guess my question is, though, like, where, because not only is footage from that film featured in it, but also The Evil Dead, The Beyond, were those written in the script, or was it a case of like, okay, what can we get? Well, obviously Night of the Living Dead's in the public domain, but with the other ones, where can we get the rights to show footage in the actual film? I know this is definitely more of the, I guess, what the director was trying to do, but were those films always part of the script?
Those films were 100% part of the script. They were like, it was really important nice. That it was those particularly. I was okay with it being Dawn of the Dead, which was actually my favorite of the then trilogy. This is before Land came out, obviously. But we ended up landing on Night. Everyone was really cool, actually. We talked to all the producers. Bruce Campbell talked to us about Evil Dead. We got like an email from him saying, yeah, you can use it. Go for your life. That was fucking amazing for me. obviously, Mr. Fulci was no longer with us by that stage, but they were okay with it, with the rights and whatnot. And yeah, they obviously we landed on Night because it was public domain and all that kind of stuff. But there was a whole section. There were two scenes that I really regret that aren't in the film that just we just ran out of time and money, basically. Mm-hmm. So the first one is there's a flashback to when Dean and Jade dating and Dean, for her birthday, because they're both piss broke stoners, for her birthday reenacts the entire script of Night of the Living Dead with like soft toys and like action figures and whatnot. And that's his like romantic present. And she's it's talking in a flashback scene. And she's like, I always knew you were a good dude then. And I love you and whatnot. This happened when they were kind of making up after he gropes her drunkenly and whatnot. So that was like a big sort of moment. The other one, and the one that I really regret not happening, was Jade, when she's looking for Mole to get a VCR back, goes wandering through the cross. And there's like a moment where she sort of, you know, we go into her mind and the cross is then just full of zombies shambling down the street. Now, I know in 2025, the idea of zombies shambling down the street is fucking boring as shit because we've had, you know, 10 years of The Walking Dead or whatever. But in 1999... that was huge. I mean, no, zombies were not, anywhere near the thing that they are now then. And like, we were really excited to do that, but it would have cost a small fortune to kind of shut down the traffic and then get extras as zombies and whatnot. So it ended up by the wayside. But I always regret, like, that would have been iconic to get that moment in. That
would have been cool.
But Night of the Living Dead looms large over, my life and definitely the life of those characters. I think it is such a... I mean, I love the remake with Tom Savini that Tom Savini did as well. I think there's something... I don't know. There's just something evergreen and primal about the setup and the story and the siege aspect that never gets off. So I've seen Bede versus the Living Dead. Is that the podcast we're talking about?
Yes.
And I was like, everything's Night of Living Dead related. I gotta watch this. This sounds good.
Yeah, well... pretty much I've got up to, I've recently, at the time of this recording, recorded my 72nd episode, and I covered all aspects of Night of the Living Dead in all forms of media. And you'd think, okay, like, there can't be that much, but surprisingly there is, because there's different, obviously, remakes than you got. Since it's in the public domain, independent filmmakers take a stab at doing a remake themselves, then there's re-edits. And then there's also
dubbings.
Yes, redubbings, and even people like making comedic redubs of the film. And then there's comic books, there's novels, and then of course when Dawn, because I also have covered the other Romero film zombie films as well. Then you got Dawn of the Dead, which has the when it was recut as zombie in Italy, that of course formed its own franchise from Zombie 2, and then of course unrelated zombie films became unofficial sequels to that franchise. It has been insane.
Yeah, right. No, I love that. I love that stuff. I love how like Dawn of the Dead became a zombie and then Zombie 2, which shares nothing of the mechanics of the zombies, and it's completely like it's a whole different thing. But still an amazing film, so yeah.
Oh yeah,
no. That era of cinema, genre cinema, is just so odd and exciting and never to be repeated, I guess.
And again, the Italians.
Love
what
the Italians.
Hell drugs were we on? But it's great.
Although I got to say though, one of the things I love about the movie, because of course Dean, since he works at the video store, he decides he's going to have a movie night. And so he just rents, and I might have to do this marathon one day of Night of the Living Dead, Evil Dead, Suspiria, and the Beyond, because I have a feeling like that's going to be just a weird, wacky journey going through all those films. You're going from the least craziest horror film to the most insane, nonsensical horror film.
Yeah, that's the order you've got to do it in. I think he chucked Suspiria in there too.
Yes.
Suspiria was there, yeah.
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 Which, to be honest, I would maybe leave out of that list, because Suspiria feels like it needs its own space, because it's quite slow and thoughtful, and it's particularly in the sort of first hour. But I think you can't go wrong with any of those films, to be honest. And, no, yeah.
Not at all. And I think it just, again, it's like it reminds me of just our life now, where it's like, all right, let's get some stoner action going, and we're going to watch three fucking weird movies for a movie day. Like, it's still universally relatable, except we're not renting them from the video store. We're finding them on Tubi, because Tubi is like a video store.
Do kids do that still? Like 20-somethings, are they still sitting around getting baked, watching horror movies and shit?
I mean, if they hang out with me, then yes, they will do that.
you just got some 20-year-olds in your house, like, you will sit there, smoke
you're
that and watch
sit,
that.
Get stoned and we're watching movies.
Exactly. I also do have another question, Anthony, like, being that you were the writer of this film, how involved were you with the actual production? Because I know from a lot of screenwriters, usually, like, the filmmakers will take the script and they'll just go off and do their own thing, and the writer, for most part, basically kind of stays out of it. How involved were you with the actual filmmaking itself, along with director Daniel Nettheim?
I was quite involved in the sense that I was on set a fair bit and I would give opinions when asked, but I wasn't kind of like when you're actually shooting, you need the director to be the boss. And then there's like, it's like a you know, military operation. You need the chain of command. So I was allowed, when asked, it was, hey, what do you think of this? I'm like, yeah, that's good. Or, you know, no, that sucks. And they would listen or whatever. That was mainly the generosity of Daniel and producer Jonathan Green. So I wasn't really instrumental. I was during the cross shoots. I was there quite a lot. And I did some of the exteriors and just hung out basically and watched it all happen. And of course I was toaster junkie. So yes. I was there for those how many days that was, which was pretty wild. But no, I was more in an observation capacity than I was in you don't want the writer's done. The writer's done their work. Mm. And so every now and then they'd say, hey, do you think this line would work better here or whatever? And I would say what I thought, but it's that the show has moved from the writer to the director and the crew by then, which is as it should be. And then in editing, you sort of come back because maybe things need to be cut, maybe things need to be reordered, and they're like, would this make sense with this? But the shoot is organized chaos, and you don't want a fucking writer just like, nah. So I was allowed on set all the time, and I had a great time doing it, but that was more because Daniel and Jonathan were nice dudes.
Yeah. As you said, you're the toaster junkie. So you did get to appear in the film.
I did.
Is Toaster Junkie based on a real, like, toaster junkie in the cross?
No one ever tried to sell me a toaster, which, again, this is an example of, like, you exaggerate for comedic effect. Yeah. But everyone tried to sell me shit all the time in King's Cross. And it was like, you could not walk down the street without being offered sex or heroin. You could not hang anywhere without something. Yeah, mate, you got it's got a VCR. I got a fucking telly. It's good. Nah, it's good.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, what if there was like a junkie that's just not very good at working out what to sell? So he's going for a toaster, and he gets quite incensed that you know he's not buying it because it does crumpets and everything and four pieces of bread. And I was quite good at the voice by then because I had so many heroin enthusiasts trying to sell me stuff or, you know, rob the store or whatever. So they told me I had to shave my beard off and then just have like a few days of ratty growth. They stuck a latex cold sore down here and they told me not to wash my hair for like a week or a few days. I can't remember. And so I really looked the part. Like I was blending in with the actual junkies of King's Cross. And shooting that on the street was wild because, again, 1999 King's Cross is very different. Mm. I was in your St. Kilda the other day, and I was getting kind of a cross vibe from it, more so than King's Cross now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I literally had to step over a heroin enthusiast to get to Woolies. Mm. And I was like, oh, this is quite the flashback. You don't get that so much more on the cross now. So, yeah, that was a kind of like wild shoot because we'd hired a gangster to keep us safe because otherwise people would just punch us and take the cameras. And we're in the film biz. We're not going to fight back. You know, we just kind of curl up on the ground,
yeah.
Dachshund puppy. So yeah, it was a real spicy kind of edgy sort of shoot that went well. But you know, we were all the time. You were like, aware of the fact that this could. Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, you had the toaster. You could just.
I could. That could have made a good weapon. So no, that was a wild time in the cross. And late too, because we had to shoot really late, like 2 o'clock in the morning kind of thing. So it was primo very hours. Primo King's Cross hours, absolutely.
I was just going to say, I'm proud to say my toaster does do 4 pieces of bread at once. So I feel proud that I have one.
That was a real boon for toasters back then. I think it's more common now, right?
But yes. Yeah, I mean, it's still. They have the basic ones, but it's like, no, I want the big one so I can get more bread in because I want more toast.
Obviously.
And also your live reading of that line, you do 4 pieces of bread at once, 4 will live forever rent-free in my head, because it was.
Oh, thanks, man.
It is hysterical. Like, the movie is very funny, so and I think... And, I mean, wasn't it, like, obviously with playing the Toaster Junkie, was it a case of that's the character you wanted to play? Or was it a case of, like, oh, do you want to appear in the movie? And they were like, okay, which small part do you want to play? And it's like, I want to play this dude.
Originally, I think I was going to do Logan, who is Dean's co-worker, who puts him on to Love Bites, the dating place. But we got Jonathan Devoy, and he was just so good at it. And... I don't know. I think I also visually looked too much like Sam Lewis. We both had a very similar, like, we wanted Jonathan Devoy had the hair and the you know, piercings and whatnot, and we needed a kind of visual distinction.
Yeah.
So Toaster Junkie was up there for a choice, because, you know, you get a little bit of dialogue, and if I was really terrible, I wouldn't ruin the film. But if I was good, people would be like, hey, you were good in that. And so that's the perfect size for an indulgent writer cameo, I think.
Yeah.
But no, it's he always gets a laugh, which is nice. And he got his own David Thrussell track on the soundtrack. Like, David Thrussell did a track called Toaster Junkie. And I was I still am a huge David Thrussell fan. And so that was very exciting.
Well, Toaster Junkie lives on.
He lives.
And also, I have to ask this. How does it feel being Nostradamus by having Evil Dead featured in your film and having director Daniel Netheim go on to direct episodes of Ash versus Evil Dead?
I know, that was crazy. He actually emailed me because he's been working in TV for a while, and I don't know that he'd seen the show, and he obviously assumed that I had, and he was like, is this show, should I do? And I'm like, motherfucker, you best be doing that. You got to do that fucking show. And he did. He did, I think, at least a couple of episodes. And they were good ones too. I mean, that was good to see. Such an unexpected treat was Ash versus Evil Dead. I know we only got 3 seasons, and it kind of finished before things got interesting. You know what's really sad too is I was in talks with the producer to, like, come on and maybe write an episode, and then the show got canned, and I was just like, oh man,
why so close?
Why? But you know what? Like, we got a 3-season continuation of the Evil Dead movies, like the older, funny, weird ones, that was gory and funny and creative. And so I'm just like, it is a miracle that we got that at all.
The fact that had 3 seasons.
It had 3 seasons.
Crazy.
And like, I get why they were probably like, yeah, now if we're going to set it, because it ends on a, spoilers, it ends on a sort of post-apocalyptic Mad Maxi note. And I can understand people were like, this is going to cost a lot of money to do this. We are a niche show.
Yeah.
Also, realizing a kind of, because it was shot in New Zealand, realizing a post-apocalypse in New Zealand might be difficult, I think, because there are not a lot of, like, sandy deserts and, you know, desolate wastelands there. So I get it. I just think it's wonderful that we ever had the show.
Yeah, it feels like it's a miracle.
I do kind of wish the newer movies, like, I've liked them. I like the last one quite a bit, but I do kind of wish they'd experiment a little with the comedy as well, because they've got the kind of horrifying gore from part one down. But I'm waiting for someone to come with that kind of surreal comedy horror that was so great in the sequel. Evil Dead 2 for me is just, you know, I'm sure I don't need to convince you to, but yeah. That to me is just like the perfect.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, and it's, I think it's because it's just that it does that absurdist comedy. And I think it's just something that Raimi and co, just because they were such big fans of the slapstick comedy, that Three Stooges, obviously, like,
yeah.
understood how to really put that into something horror. And I think it'd be fun if we saw that again, but I don't know if he can recreate what he managed to recreate, because it's just his own brand of
I wouldn't want anyone I wouldn't want anyone to ape the Sam Raimi, but in the same way that they've taken kind of the tone of the first films in Rise and the Evil Dead remake,
like, you can do it. It should be done.
I think there's a director who could do it. I don't know who offhand, but I think there is kind of someone out there who could find a modern version of that lunacy. I'd like to see that. I mean, I like them anyway, but I would like to see that.
They lean so much on how horrific
things
are.
They were killing kids in the last one.
Come on.
Kids were dying in the last one. I was like, God damn. All right. Well,
I just want to laugh for like a second.
Yeah. Well, speaking of horror films, I keep telling Marcy this all the time when it comes to Angst, that I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts on it. Like, this, of course, Angst came out in 2000. Another film that came out in 2000, another Australian film, which was a horror film, Cut.
Nice.
For some bizarre reason, I always associate Cut and Angst together, almost like kind of like the yin and yang of each other. And it's not because both Sam Loomis and Jessica Napier are in both movies. I mean, it probably has something to do with that. But I don't know. I always kind of see like Angst as the unofficial sequel or prequel to Cut. And sort of thinking about it now, Cut would probably be the type of films Daniel would have written in his video Dean. Stop. There, sorry, Dean, I didn't say. Dean in his video shop says.
you know what's funny too is I went for the job of writing Cut at the same time as, so around that time. Mm. And I mean, I was a young writer with very little experience, so I didn't get it. I got quite far along from what I understand. Maybe my agent was lying to me, but that's what I understand. Mm. But I didn't end up getting it. And I was actually quite heartbroken because I thought I could have done a really good job on that. But yeah, no, I think having Sam in a major role in that and having Jesse in there as well, I totally get. And there is a kind of similar grimy 90s vibe to both films. So yeah, no, I could understand why you'd associate them. Also, single word titles.
Yeah.
I get it. I wish I'd gotten that job, because then there could be a real kind of crossover element there.
Yeah.
Sadly, it was not to be.
Yeah, I actually never, until B mentioned it, it didn't clock. And I'm like, wait, the same actors in both movies. And they're very, like, I almost feel like there's love letters in there to just horror cinema. And I'm like, yeah, they kind of really do go well as, like, a pairing with that yin and yang thing. It's kind of interesting, because I did watch Cut after I watched Angst, just based on what B said. I'm like, yeah, this is actually really fun. Just like, and enjoy the actors in different but almost similar roles. Like, it's interesting.
No, absolutely.
It was definitely an interesting time, I guess, for Australian cinema in the sort of that period.
It was interesting, and we very rarely made horror movies, which is why I was very excited to go for that job. Nowadays, of course, you've got the Philippou brothers, you've got the Cairns brothers, a lot of brothers making film. And, you know, horror and genre and exploitation films are pretty much expected, and they're the ones that make big at the box office. But then it was a very slim margin of films that were getting made, and they were not well respected at all, which was strange given like kind of Australia's history with genre film, and, you know, your Mad Maxes and you know, your Razorbacks and whatnot. But that's just how it was at the time. It was a weird time, the 90s.
But I do look back fondly on what we did get out of the 90s again.
I do as well.
You know, Angst came from the 90s. Even though it was released in 2000s, it is,
as you mentioned,
it's a very 90s.
It's hard. It's very 90s. Like, it's still living in the 90s, even if the world was living in the 2000s.
I mean, I'm still living in the 90s. It was, a couple of years ago, the 90s?
Me too. Yes. The fact that you know, something from 2000 is 25 years old, I find very insulting.
I refuse to believe it.
I do not care for that nonsense. Thank you.
No. Not at all. But obviously, since, I mean, Angst was 25 years ago, like, you've still been writing. Obviously, we spoke about, why am I forgetting the name of the film?
Red Ink.
Because it's got like six names. Like, it's Red Ink in Australia, and it's in Human Resources in America.
Yeah.
Ed Hunt in Germany and Japan. Yes, that was
Red Ink
time.
Was here. With that. But I mean, even since then, you've published some books. I just wanted you to sort of have the platform, if people aren't aware, what books you've written and put out there as well.
Straya is the kind of Mad Max-ish story set in Sydney in a kind of post-apocalyptic rollicking adventure. Lots of violence and swears and kind of Australian slang. And then I followed up with Emma After, which is more of a spooky YA ghost story. If you've got a teen coming of age, or if you just like a bit of YA spooky teen ghost shenanigans. I'm actually at the moment adapting Straya into an animated movie with Kriv Stenders of Red Dog and the Diplomat fame. So that's very early stages at this stage, but that's very exciting.
That actually sounds really cool. Like, that's such a good platform for a story.
Now is a good time to go and read Straya, I would say. You know, get it now, so that when you watch the movie and go, oh well, the book was better. You know, in that shitty way that we do.
The book's better.
Oh yeah. But yeah, so that's what's going on. I've also got something cooking with the Angst guys, actually, with Daniel Nertime and Jonathan Green, but I'm not really talking about it yet, but we're sort of having meetings about it, and I'm writing something as we speak. Not an Angst sequel, but, you know, not a million miles away thematically from the kind of vibe of that film. So that's been fun to revisit that kind of thing. Cool.
I guess, Anthony, for my last question before we wrap up, and this is a hypothetical question. Now, a lot of people do, especially I would say in the last 5-10 years, filmmakers will go back to making a sequel to an earlier film of theirs, especially a film like this where it's about a bunch of characters at a specific point in their lives. Like, say, for example, like the Before Sunrise, Before Sunset.
Mm. I mean, even Trainspotting, like,
yeah,
who thought exactly. That would have a sequel? What?
So if you had an, like, in your opinion, like, if you were writing an Angst 2, where would you see our main characters? Where are they now?
I actually had a concept for like an Angst sequel that had elements of a prequel. It was called Sweaty, Confused, and Slightly Aroused.
That's an amazing title.
Love it.
So part of it dealt with Dean and Jade's past and their romance, because I was really in love with them as a couple and I wanted to see how that all worked. And the other part was kind of things not going entirely right. So Ian ends up becoming a really famous stand-up comedian, but he hates it. And Dean does not become a filmmaker and he gets quite bitter and jaded and whatnot. And I kind of wanted to have the dynamic of kind of Ian coming back to town and he and Dean are a bit offside at first and then they reconnect and then they start working on something together and they maybe make a film or they shoot something. I wasn't sure where Jade and Mole fit in, but I was going to find a place for them. And I wasn't entirely sure where May fit in. Maybe they reconnect or I don't know. So it was not a completely formed idea, but it was just a bunch of stuff that I thought was interesting. So I didn't want to do a Dawson's Creek. Remember Dawson's Creek at the end? He's like, I got a meeting with Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. I mean, it's nice. And it's a nice show. But like, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do like, what if shit doesn't go right? What if Ian's the one that kind of takes off? And so like, Ian becomes like a Jim Jefferies, but he kind of hates it because he's got to constantly play
honestly,
up to that.
Honestly, like, because when you watch it, you're like, oh, it's... sort of like it makes you feel good at the end, but you wonder like what would happen to these characters. And honestly, that is so the direction I could see for them. Like, I can imagine Dean would be failed at what he wants to do, but there's a way that he can kind of reclaim it. And I can absolutely picture like, yeah, he's a stand-up comedian, but he kind of freaking hates it, because I can imagine that would be grating after so long. So I definitely can see that.
Yeah, obviously never happened because, you know, the film sort of wasn't in a position to support that.
But it would have been interesting. I don't know. I tend to do that with most of what I write. I tend to like just jot down what could happen next and what happened beforehand, usually not for public consumption, just because, you know, when you live with a story for that long, it's hard to let go completely.
Yeah.
And so you've just got to kind of like get it out of your system and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would have been the vibe, I think. in another dimension.
But one last, I think, question. It might be the best question to wrap it up on.
G'day.
So, is the spoofing on soft animals something that actually happened and somebody was like, oh, my God, get out of my house. You came on my stuffed toy.
I wish I could say that it was. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But I will tell you where it all came from. And that was, and I can't remember who this was. I think this was like a mate of a girlfriend that I had in like the 90s. And he told me, I think it happened to him. And he said, you know, my parents were killed by a volcano. And so this woman got me to go to the volcano and masturbate into the crater. And I'm like, I was sort of half listening as you do at a party. And then I was like, motherfucker, you got to tell me this entire story. Like, sit down, everyone else fuck off. And yeah, he told me. Now, he could have been lying his ass off. I didn't care. Like, he was lying convincingly. And I was like, this story is amazing. I can't remember because, again, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, I can't remember if it happened to him or if it happened to his mate or what have you, but like for the sake of argument, we'll say it happened to him. And yeah, and he said it was really freeing to masturbate into the crater of the volcano, and he felt inner peace like he never had before. And immediately I was like, I got to jerk off into a volcano. And two, this is a great story that I've got to use. By the way, the cow story as well, the hanging the cow up so it wouldn't have to use its hooves, was a story a teacher of mine told at assembly, and it was just the most baffling story because like they hang the cow up and then it dies anyway. And I was like, what was the message of this story?
What was that?
I remembered that from high school. I was like, that's going in something too. That's kind of what it is being a writer. You spend a lot of time going, that's going in something. That's going in something.
It's either your own experience or secondhand or thirdhand knowledge that gets passed down as things.
So the spoofing on the soft toys was just like, how could that be funny? Like, how could I
make that funny.
Work with a volcano? So yeah.
It's so funny. The
sorry
the
to disappoint.
The flashback scene where it's like he's does it on the toy. She's just like, get out of this.
Can I tell
dying.
You in the script as written, you actually see the load land on the teddy bear, and I remember Daniel was really against that. And then I remember something about Mary came out, and I was like, see? We could have been the pioneers of load. But no, I'm kind of glad we didn't in retrospect. At the time, I was like, damn, could have been us.
It could have been. But it just, scenes like that just kill me because the thing is, it feels so real. Like, I can see that happening.
Yeah.
And the fact is like, stories that get related and you have ideas, like, it's just so good. And with the spoof, I think that's our interview discussion.
On that elevated note, viewers,
yes,
you are welcome.
Thank you so much for taking the time out to join us and discuss the film and chat to us. And
thank you both.
Again, where can people find Angst right now with its re-release?
Find a physical copy at JB Hi-Fi and plus the normal places that you order from online if you don't want to go in store. It is on VOD, on Amazon Prime, Fetch, Foxtel, Apple TV. I'm forgetting one, but like it's all there. Like it's pretty much everywhere. Everywhere you buy films to watch, YouTube. YouTube movies and Google movies. So please don't make it the most stolen movie again. Let's actually
pay for it and watch it.
It's pretty cheap. So go on.
Definitely
come
get
on
a physical copy because physical media is still
key. And there's extras on that. So if you want to see, you know,
love you extras.
Know, yeah.
We love extras. But yes, if people haven't seen it before since it was on VHS, now's your time to see it. If you've never seen it, you can enjoy spoofing on plush animal toys because it's funny. But once again, thank you so much. And hopefully it won't be a million years between chats again.
I hope that too.
We hope to have you back on soon. Thank you so much, Anthony.
All right, legends. Thank you.
Much love. Thank you. And there you have it, everyone. That was our interview with Anthony O'Connor and talking about all things Angst. And as you heard, you can find that available. So if you have not seen this film, please go out of your way to check it out. You will not regret it. And as usual, you can find us at supermarcy.com. And of course, you can sign up and listen to all the wonderful podcasts that we have here at the Super Network via the Super Podcast podcast feeds on Apple, Spotify, and other players as well. And if you want to find me, I am on the social medias as Super Marcy, and you can find me on Letterboxd at Super_Marcy and see all the wonderful things I decide to watch, and it usually makes no sense. And Bede, what about for yourself?
Well, people want to find me personally out there on the internet. You can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can find all my work over on supermarcy.com. And also, you can follow my solo podcast, Bede versus the Living Dead, and its many spin-off shows over on all podcast streamers everywhere.
Absolutely. And be sure to do that, everybody. And hopefully it won't be too long between episodes again. But we thank you so much for tuning in for this episode, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
See you, everyone. Bye.
I don't know why I haven't been happy lately. I mean, I've got some good advice from some close friends.
You should try ugly chicks, they have lower standards.
A good relationship with my flatmate, Jade.
Dane!
And my ex-girlfriend, Heather, still likes me heaps.
I never, ever want to see you again!
Plus, there's my job where the customers love me.
You think you're so original, stroking your goatee, exuding disdain. But you're just another smirking, wannabe clone.
So what's with all this angst?
Who's that?
Well, we don't actually know, but he bought a slab, so we let him in.
How do you guys tell each other about a nightclub?
Don't make me hurt you.
Oh, and I kicked a dog.
Why?
Because he looked like he was going to start some shit. Mean little Pekingese bastard.